much fun as they're having over there in their class. Just to be clear. All right, lesson two in our study of Daniel. If anyone doesn't happen to have a lesson study guide, there are, Keith's got a couple back there. Anybody doesn't have one, so feel free to grab one. We still have a few left, but they're going like hotcakes. All right, Daniel chapters 3 and 4. But before we get into that, what quick refresh from last week. What were some of our kind of key learnings, key takeaways, key reminders for those that have studied Daniel multiple times already? Yeah, just the fortitude that they showed, the faith that Daniel and his three friends showed in just not conforming to what was really being imposed upon them and expected of them. Right. What else? Any other key practical lessons, key takeaways? I know I kind of caught you by surprise, though. Sarah? Easy now. Don't make generalizations. And I think it's really striking, too, when you figure whatever the environment was that they were raised in their younger years. Because remember, they were in the nation of Judah, which was being judged for evil, right, and wickedness and all of that. And somehow, somewhere, they had some good influences in their life and lived that out. Tony, you had your hand up.
Yeah, just went along that line. We always think about chapter 1, that was used in this thing, but when you look at the timeline in chapter 2 that's given at the very beginning, those events are either during that 3-year period of the training or right after it. So
right.
He's still a young man when he had the courage to go to Nebuchadnezzar and say, hey, can you give us some time?
Right.
And they, just the vision that he has there in God's revelation, just the demonstration of his power and how he has the plan and control over there.
Yeah. All good points. Daniel is just one of those just really upstanding character examples to really just take away from and learn a lot from. And then, too, the prophecy that is revealed, right, the interpretation of that dream and the revelation from God through Daniel to Nebuchadnezzar that, look, this is future history, right? This is what's going to happen after you and after Babylon. These other kingdoms are going to arise. But in the days of this final fourth kingdom is when the kingdom of God is going to, the kingdom of heaven is going to be established. It's going to encompass the entire earth. It's going to really put an end to human kingdoms as far as their influence over people and so forth. That's going to be what's ultimately victorious. So I think that's something too for us to keep in mind. And we mentioned over in the New Testament in Mark chapter 9 verse 1, Jesus told the people that were right there that this kingdom that had been prophesied about as far back as Daniel, even back before then, was about to come about in their lifetimes, and that they weren't going to pass away before the kingdom of heaven was going to be established. So that's how we connect the timeline here. All right, so, go ahead. I'm sorry, I don't know your name. What's your
name? My name's Pat. Daniel's prayer in 2:20 through 23 is, God, help me to is so wonderful, and I think it's a good introduction to
response to his revelation of the dream, he knows that God, he implies that he had asked for God, and God wants us to ask, and God had answered him. He says, "You have given me wisdom and might, and have now made known to me what we ask of you. For you have made known to us the king's command." He had asked his friends, Mishael and Hananiah and Azariah, to pray with him, and so there was power of that they received power to pray for one another and pray together. But that revelation of secrets is what Nebuchadnezzar mentions in verse 47. He says, "Truly, your God is the God of God, the King of the Lord of Kings, and a revealer of secrets, since you have revealed this secret." And because he revealed the secret, and he still is a revealer of secrets, that Nebuchadnezzar had some beginnings of belief here in the true God.
Yeah, I do think we see kind of an evolution of Nebuchadnezzar's understanding of God from really chapter 1 all the way through chapter 4 that we'll talk about that this evening. So that is a good point. So we talked about that. Certainly God's sovereignty over the nations, as you know, is revealed in these chapters, and the prophecy of the establishment of God's kingdom. So let's get into chapter 3. What do we have here? We have Nebuchadnezzar setting up this image of gold, and he sets it up in what's called the Plain of Dura in Babylon, so somewhere in the province of Babylon, and he gathers together this collection of the government officials to attend to the dedication, says, of this image. Now recall that back at the end of chapter 2, the three comrades of Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, who were given these Chaldean names of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and they seemed to, the narrative seems to shift to referring to them with those Aramaic or those Chaldean names now. So those three individuals, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, were appointed by Nebuchadnezzar to be government officials. So they're included in this gathering of these government officials. And so, what's the purpose of this image? What's the first question that I had there? What was the command that was given regarding when the music would play? And there's this long list of musical instruments that would sound. What was the command? Right. Once you hear all this, picture there's all these government officials, right? So Nebuchadnezzar's conquered all these nations, and so there are government administrators and officials and so forth, probably from various different nationalities, languages even. They're all standing before this image, and in verse 4, this herald loudly proclaims, all right, when you hear all this music, you are to bow down. You're to bow down and worship this image. What do you think is the motivation for that? Right. Yeah, I think that's right. It was, you know, we're not really told the motivation here, but, you know, you've got Nebuchadnezzar, who is the emperor of all this, who has conquered all of these various nations. He's a pagan. He's polytheistic, right? He seems to be interested in a whole variety of gods. And the mindset in those ancient times, of course, was whoever was, you know, successful in military and in conquest and so forth, well, their god defeated whoever the other god was. So there's probably an effort for some acknowledgement from all these different people from these different backgrounds that the god of the Babylonians has conquered whoever and whatever their particular god was. And then I think unifying all of them and expressing and confessing really their loyalty to Babylon, to Nebuchadnezzar. So Do you think that this was religious persecution? It certainly, yeah. So,
verse 12 indicates that when they come and complain about it, they say, oh, King, they have not paid due regard to you. So there's the mindset that whatever they do to the golden image, they're also going to Nebuchadnezzar, they're one and the same.
Okay. All right. Nick? Was there an effort to stop the various government officials who were gathered from whatever their religious practices were? Yeah. Right. Yeah. He's not necessarily trying to stop the government officials from worshiping whatever god they were worshiping and practicing whatever pagan practice they had. Now, in the case of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, of course, part of their faith is not worshiping any other images, right? So perhaps he unwittingly was, you know, really opposing, you know, any Jews who were there. And so the reason that I kind of talk about that a little bit is some will say, oh, well, this is just like a story that was written hundreds of years later as a parallel to what Antiochus Epiphanes did in Jerusalem, you know, in the time of the Maccabees, in really trying to put out and extinguish Judaism at that time. And they're really not parallel accounts, because Nebuchadnezzar, he's not really trying to put out Judaism. He's really just trying to say, hey, you know, this is who I want you to worship, bow down and worship in. And it doesn't really seem to be putting a stop to any of the others there in what they were necessarily practicing. And what was the penalty for bowing down? The Herald explains it. Yes. You're going to get thrown into the fiery furnace. And so we know how the account goes. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, you know, the music sounds. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego refuse to do that. And so there's an accusation brought by some of the Chaldeans, and they bring, you know, you picture them, they're running right to Nebuchadnezzar with the accusation about them not bowing down and not worshiping. And what might be the motivation for that, for these government officials to go, you know, tell Nebuchadnezzar about these three Jews? Yeah, it certainly seems easy to reason that, yeah, there was probably some jealousy going. We're not told that explicitly, but it seems like that could easily have been the case. And so, you know, I think it's a lesson for us, right? They were accused for doing what was right. And I think that is a lesson for us, that we can do the right thing. We can't control how others are going to react to that, or what others may do, you know, to us, against us, in opposition to us. And so that, I think that's a real lesson for us. So what would have been wrong with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego bowing down to this idol? Why didn't they just go along? Nick. Okay, so our God is a jealous God. How would they have known that? We talked about their, you know, their upbringing and how they must have had some good influences in their life. Okay. So from Deuteronomy, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy mind, with all thy soul. How would they have, you know, put this kind of in a modern, I could see somebody rationalizing, well, I still love God. but I'm going to also just kind of go along here just to, whatever, preserve my life. Look over, just, I think the most explicit point is in the law of Moses itself. So just flip over to Exodus chapter 20. And I think this is probably what was in their mind when, you know, they heard the command and heard the music. So in Exodus chapter 20, going all the way back to the giving of the law from God to Moses at Mount Sinai in the wilderness, among the commandments, starting in verse 4, you shall not make for yourself an idol or any likeness of what is in heaven above or on the earth beneath or in the water underneath the earth. You shall not worship them or serve them. For I, the Lord your God, to the next point, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children, on the third and fourth generations of those who hate me, but showing loving kindness to thousands, to those who love me and keep my commandments. So I think it's reasonable to conclude that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, or Abednego, they knew this, and this is what was in their mind and in their heart when they heard this. Now, think about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego themselves. Why might they have been so steadfast in this? Where had they come from? Jerusalem. And what had happened to Jerusalem? It hadn't been destroyed. But what was happening to the nation of Judah and to Jerusalem? We've been talking about it for.
They were brought into captivity. They were the first.
Yeah.
Taken into captivity.
Right. So they were, you know, they were among those taken into captivity, as had been prophesied, and which was judgment on the beginning of judgment on the people. And so you've got these young guys, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They know the law, apparently. They've witnessed firsthand the judgment of God for idolatry. And so now they've been taken, you know, hundreds of miles away from their home into a completely alien environment and culture. And they get it. They understand God means what he says. This is his law. And so they're going to, you know, they're going to obey and they're going to be steadfast in that. And, you know, I think that, you know, we don't know much about those three before they get to Babylon. But, you know, I think that is what was happening with the captivity and all of that was a form of chastening. And we, you know, we talk about chastening, and chastening is a topic that comes up in the scriptures. And if we look over in Proverbs chapter 3, which is where we've been focused all year. So Proverbs chapter 3, we've got the verses, you know, 5 and 6 that have really been our focus this year, talking about trusting in the Lord. But interestingly, if you drop down to verses 11 and 12 in Proverbs chapter 3, it says, my son, do not reject the discipline of the Lord or loathe his reproof. For whom the Lord loves, he reproves, even as a father corrects the son in whom he delights. So they knew the law. They had firsthand seen the judgment that was coming upon the nation for its idolatry. And, you know, that's a form of chastening. And so I have to believe that they just put all that together and they just understood it. And it resulted in them, you know, their steadfastness. All right. Any other points on that? Brings them into direct conflict with Nebuchadnezzar. So Nebuchadnezzar, you know, he's told about them. The accusation comes to him from these Chaldeans. And how does Nebuchadnezzar respond to the accusation about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? What?
He's angry.
Okay, he's angry. Okay. Tony.
He actually, he orders them to come in.
Yeah.
But, you know, right now he's giving them another chance.
Right. Yeah. And so he inquires himself. And it does. It almost seems like, yeah, he's kind of giving them a chance to change their mind, perhaps. Or
what he did is, you'll go ahead and do
yeah.
it now. Basically, all he's got.
Right. 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 Yeah, he tells them that, gives them an opportunity to change. But before they even have a chance to respond, he also gives them the ultimatum. And in the ultimatum is this rhetorical question that he asks. And what's the rhetorical question that he asks when he tells them about what the ultimatum is to be thrown into this fiery furnace, you know, if you don't bow down? What's the rhetorical question? Yeah. So Nebuchadnezzar, he's set up this, you know, 90-foot image, and, you know, who is the God who can deliver you from out of my hand? And I just love Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego's response. And I don't know if they all three said it at the same time or if one of them, you know, stepped up and said it. I don't know exactly how. But what's their response to that question? Verse 16. Yeah, we don't, you know, it depends what translation you're reading, but something like, we don't even need to give you an answer. Like, there's no hesitation at all in their answer. And they just, you know, we don't even need to give you an answer. And their answer is, God is going to, you know, God can deliver us from your hand. Let's just read verse 16 together. Daniel chapter 3. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to give you an answer concerning this matter. If it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the furnace of blazing fire, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But even if he does not, let it be known to you, O king, that we are not going to serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." So I just love that response. There's no hesitation, just absolutely firm and steadfast in their response. What else do you notice about their response, at least the very first part of when they address Nebuchadnezzar, compared maybe to how the Chaldeans address Nebuchadnezzar? The Chaldeans come to Nebuchadnezzar, "O king, live forever," right? And in Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego's response, how do they address him first? "O Nebuchadnezzar." They don't even acknowledge that he's king. They say, "O Nebuchadnezzar." I don't know if there's much in there, but it's just that much more emphatic, I think, in their response that they're not intimidated by Nebuchadnezzar. Now, later on in their response, they do refer to him as king, so they weren't necessarily being insolent there. Keith? That's right. That's right.
We're talking about God.
Yeah.
Way above you. And I think that maybe the reason why in this case they just call him Nebuchadnezzar, because he's nothing compared to God.
Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah. And they have no doubt. And really, regardless of what the outcome is, right, they know they're going to be thrown in, and they know that God may or may not choose to save them, which I think is a really good illustration. If you look over in Job, one of the things that Job says, Job chapter 13, you know, Job certainly had his hardships, as we all know. Job chapter 13, one of the things he says down in verse 15, "Though he slay me, I will hope in him." And not that God was going to be the ones to want to slay Shadrach, Meshach, but even if, you know, they knew that even if he chooses not to save their bodies, they belong to him, and that their souls will be saved by him. This whole incident also is referred to over in, you know, Hebrews chapter 11 is one of the great examples of faith. It doesn't mention them by name, but that, you know, they quenched the fiery furnace. So, oh, Danny.
Mm-hmm. God doesn't allow.
Yeah.
They wouldn't have had that opportunity for experience.
Yeah.
Please tell me, they knew the scrolls.
Yeah.
They had studied the words.
Yeah.
They might have been a little bit overwhelmed. They could carry this word before them. And our God told us to cooperate, but he told us not to be disobedient.
Yeah.
So we'll cooperate to the extent that if he does not draw us into disobedience.
Right.
So when he does, when we stand up,
right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a challenging lesson for us. Jeremiah. Right. Yeah, there's just, you know, we talk all night about this incident and all the various facets of it and the lessons to be drawn away. So, you know, just kind of continue moving through the incident or the account. So, you know, of course, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. First, the furnace is heated up 7 times hotter than it normally is. You know, Nebuchadnezzar, if nothing, he's certainly an emphatic kind of guy. So he, you know, cranks up the furnace. He gets 3 of his, you know, or however many, we don't know the number, but he gets some strong warriors to bind up these 3, take them to the furnace. On the way, somehow in all of that, right, the warriors are killed by the heat. And so Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, it says, fall bound into the furnace. And what does Nebuchadnezzar see? You get this image that he's positioned to watch exactly, you know, wants to see them just roasted in this furnace. What does he see? Yeah, he sees, first he's astounded, it says, or, you know, different words like that, startled, alarmed, and he stands up in haste, and he sees several things. He sees that there's 4, not 3 people in there. And that they're not bound any longer, but they're walking around free, that they're unharmed. And what does he say about that 4th person who appeared in the furnace with them? Looks like a son of the gods, right? Doesn't really identify who that was. And all Nebuchadnezzar is able to see. Remember, you know, Nebuchadnezzar, he's a pagan. He has all these different ideas of, you know, different gods and so forth. But he sees that there's a 4th person in there who looks different than the 3 that we just threw in there. And from Nebuchadnezzar's perspective, someone who looks like a son of the gods, something very special about this this fourth person in there. So he then goes ahead and calls them out of the furnace. I had a question in there in the lesson. Just, we won't spend a whole lot of time on this, but just when we think about this example and then we, you know, apply it to ourselves, what are some of the kind of current maybe social norms that we're exposed to? And, you know, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were expected to worship this image. And there are things in our society and in culture that we're, you know, society expects us to celebrate. You know, worship. What might some of those be? Because we face a lot, you know, some of the same pressures that these 3 faced. Scott. Okay. Yeah, we see a lot of that. Any and all forms of sexual perversion are really just, you know, celebrated. Okay. What else? Joe? Okay. Yeah, there's more than one way, right? You've got your truth, I can have my truth, let's just tolerate each other, and we worship tolerance now, really, more than anything else. Do you see any other hands? Oh, Pat?
I think verse 12, when the Chaldeans accused them of not bowing to the same thing, they brought up the their Jews. So they knew that Jews worship only one God, and that's offensive to today's world, that was
Yeah. Professing that there is truth, that there is objective truth, which excludes anything that is not a part of that truth as false, that is, you know, that is persecuted these days. No question about that. Okay, so, you know, they fall into the fire. Nebuchadnezzar sees what he sees, and he calls to them. He calls for them to actually come out of the furnace. And let's go ahead and read, starting in verse 28, then, chapter 3, down towards the end of chapter 3. Nebuchadnezzar responded and said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants who put their trust in him, violating the king's command, and yielded up their bodies so as not to serve or worship any god except their own god. Therefore, I make a decree that any people, nation, or tongue that speaks anything offensive against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb and their houses reduced to a rubbish heap, inasmuch as there is no other God who is able to deliver in this way." Then the king caused Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to prosper in the Babylon, in the province of Babylon. So, interesting response of Nebuchadnezzar. So, to what extent did he acknowledge the true and living God? Or did he? Okay, he certainly says nobody can deliver like this. Nick?
He thought, okay, there's something to this. I don't want any part of it. So that's...
Yeah, yeah. And I'm curious, you know, it says we didn't read all the verses, but when Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego come out of the furnace, all these other government officials gathered around them, and I'm curious if the ones who had brought the accusation were in that crowd around them, seeing what had happened and how they might have felt about that, along with that point of not wanting to be on the other side of this God who's just demonstrated his power.
I
Suzanne.
Think it's kind of funny because up to this point, like, the most powerful God in the story is Nebuchadnezzar.
Right.
Like, in his mind, he's the one that, you know, was able to, like, disintegrate all the guards. And,
yeah.
Like, you know, and so I think it's kind of funny because as soon as he sees that someone or that God was more powerful than he was,
yeah,
he was afraid.
Right.
I think that's his absolute response. It's not that, oh, we need to turn our lives around and worship this God. It's no one say anything bad about that God, you know, but
yeah,
still worship me. Because I think that's the thing. He wasn't seeing action from other gods.
Uh-huh.
He was proving his action to his people.
Right.
He was being their God on earth.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. Tony, did you?
Well, I touched on at the beginning whenever we were talking about chapter 2 and Nebuchadnezzar's response,
mm-hmm,
and how we start getting a glimpse of him, and it's like, yeah, he needs major anger management counseling. But
yeah,
whenever he's confronted and he's shown, hey, and he sees God's hand at work,
yeah,
he acknowledges it.
Uh-huh.
He
yeah
doesn't mess around or anything. He's clearly acknowledged he hadn't yet got the full understanding there,
right,
and we'll get to that in a second.
Yeah.
But to his credit,
yeah,
you know, we get one to this part here, and at least they give him that credit after this point.
Right. He's getting there, right? What did he leave out? Where in his response, what did he leave out? Yeah. You know, that he is the only true and living God, and we're going to get rid of all of these other false gods and false idols. He doesn't go that far, right? He's Nebuchadnezzar's still a pagan. In his mind, it's just, wow, this God is the most high God, you know, among all of these. I can kind of picture him being on Mars Hill when Paul was there, right? Maybe one of those that was, you know, worshiping all these idols. Okay. Any other thoughts or comments on chapter 3? Nick? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. Right. Yeah. Exactly. All right. So let's talk about chapter 4. So it begins with this statement of Nebuchadnezzar in verses 1. Well, really verse 3. How great are his signs and how mighty are his wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom and his dominion is from generation to generation. So the chapter starts out with Nebuchadnezzar praising God, praising who he calls the Most High God in verse 2. And then it's almost like verse 4 kind of starts a flashback. Like this is okay, now I'm going to tell you how I got to this point to make these statements and assertions about God and the lesson that he learned, because spoiler alert, when you get to the end of the chapter, verse 34, he basically, at the end of his whole experience that we'll talk about, makes a very similar statement there at the end of this experience. So this chapter is written it's written in the first person, a lot of it from the perspective of Nebuchadnezzar. So we're hearing, you know, from Nebuchadnezzar this experience that he has, and he has a dream. We're told it's a time of peace, and he has this dream. And what is the dream? I've got a picture of a tree on here, so that's a dead giveaway, a live giveaway. Okay, so he has a vision of a dream, and what are the components, or what happens?
Large tree that all the nations folks flow to and everything, but it got down. But there would be a band put around it to keep it so that it can be restored.
Right. So big tree. I think the birds are up in the branches. The animals are all around. There's plenty of food from this tree. And then there's this voice from heaven. A watcher comes down, says, cut the tree down. It falls, and there's an iron band. They said, leave the stump and its roots, and there's an iron band attached around the stump. And so, you know, once again, we're in this, you know, Nebuchadnezzar finds himself in this situation. He has this dream, doesn't know what it means. He calls in, you know, the Chaldeans, the conjurers, all his wise men and so forth to interpret it. None of them are able to interpret it. Until Daniel comes in, and what's Daniel's interpretation of the dream? Is Daniel happy about good news for the king? No, he kind of, you know, when Nebuchadnezzar relates the dream to him, Daniel's troubled for a period of time, and it seems Nebuchadnezzar can tell that. And so he just, you know, he tells Daniel, you know, tell me what the dream means. He wants to hear it. And so what was the interpretation of the dream? Yeah, right. So the fact that, yeah, Nebuchadnezzar was going to be humbled. Daniel, you know, when he introduces the interpretation, he says, oh, I wish this wasn't for you, Nebuchadnezzar. I wish this was for, you know, one of your enemies or someone else. And the interpretation begins in verse 24. This is the interpretation, O king. and this is the decree of the Most High, which has come upon my Lord the King, that you be driven away from mankind, and your dwelling place be with the beasts of the field, and you be given grass to eat like cattle, and be drenched with the dew of heaven, and 7 periods of time will pass over you until you recognize that the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind and bestows it on whomever he wishes. And so, based on this interpretation of the dream, what's Daniel's advice to Nebuchadnezzar? Or does he have any advice?
Repent.
Yeah, right. Repent. Verse 27. Therefore, O king, may my advice be pleasing to you. Break away now from your sins by doing righteousness, and from your iniquities by showing mercy to the poor, in case there may be a prolonging of your prosperity. So notice it's not to avoid the judgment. The judgment has been decreed. This is going to happen. Daniel's advice is repent, you know, do these things so that your prosperity may be prolonged. Maybe it'll be longer before this humbling takes place. So we get it to verse 28, and the narrative now shifts to third person. So perhaps, you know, Daniel writing now about what happened to Nebuchadnezzar. And how long after the dream are we now reading about in verses 28 and following, where we actually see the fulfillment of the dream? How much time lapses? Yeah, 12 months. So about a year between the dream itself and the fulfillment of the interpretation. And so the king is walking about, and, you know, he expresses really his pride in verse 30. Is this not Babylon the great, which I myself have built as a royal residence by the might of my power for the glory of my majesty? And how quickly does God humble him? Immediately. The words are still in his mouth, and everything that he had foreseen in the dream happens and comes true. And humbles him until Nebuchadnezzar learns this lesson. And when does it end? When does his humbling end? Well, 7 periods of time. And what seems to happen that maybe that brings an end to this period of judgment?
He comes to understand his reasoning. Is there a need? Basically, he gets it.
Yeah.
That's so I think that's 7 periods of time more figurative.
Right.
Okay. It's going to be enough time. It's going to be complete.
Yeah.
But however long it takes for you to come around and see who God truly is.
Yeah.
And that he is over you.
Right. Yeah. And that he lifts up his eyes to heaven and really acknowledges God at that point. And then we noted verse 34, his dominion, he says his. Right. Right. That's right. Yeah. And it says, you know, he lifted his eyes to heaven and his reason returned to him. He blesses the Most High, praise and honor him who lives forever. And then he, you know, kind of concludes with that statement again. His dominion is an everlasting dominion and his kingdom endures from generation to generation, which is actually verbatim from the 145th Psalm. And so, you know, it could be that maybe Daniel had, you know, taught Nebuchadnezzar that psalm, or Nebuchadnezzar perhaps had heard that from Daniel at some point. But the wording there is almost identical to that. So when we look at these, you know, these accounts that we have in these chapters, and we kind of look at it and we think about it, you know, within the frame of our verses in Proverbs chapter 3, what are some of the lessons that we take away from these again? We talked about a lot of them already, but just kind of bringing it all back together again. What are some of the lessons here as far as trusting the Lord and not leaning on our own understanding and acknowledging him, not being wise in our own eyes, fearing the Lord? What do we see there? acknowledging him in all of his house. So how did you see that? And
I mean, just
these accounts.
You see nothing other had multiple chances. He gets it, like God, he's like giving him another chance, and then all of a sudden it's like the second he's like, no, I'm so great, look at all that I've built, you know, he strikes him down. Until he was able to completely humble and acknowledge God in all of his ways, mm-hmm. he wasn't sure.
So really, Nebuchadnezzar is kind of a negative example, right, of not acknowledging God in all of your ways. Until the end, we do kind of see him come around there. Okay, good. Any other thoughts on applications here, Tony?
Trust
yeah.
They show
yeah.
Interact.
Right.
The ultimate.
Yeah, the trust, the and also I think the fearing the Lord, right? Fearing the Lord implies not fearing really anybody else. Fearing the Lord, that's who we are to fear. I think they certainly demonstrated that. Not being
the easy way out would be Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are a positive example of all these principles
Yeah, very good. Yeah, very good contrast between them. Exactly. Good. Any other thoughts?
It's like AA, the first step in AA and all the steps are the steps is admit you're powerless, and that's what he does. You have to come to the bottom in order to return to God and
Yeah, good. Good point. All right. Thanks, everyone.